Welcome to the Celtic Myth Pod Show, bringing the tales and stories of the ancient Celts to your fireside.
Episode SP26, Samhain Holiday Special 2011. Hello, welcome to the Celtic Myth Pod Show. I'm Gary.
And I'm Ruth. Before we start, I'd like to say a big thank you for downloading this holiday special, as well as all our other stories. It means an awful lot to us.
It does. Mm. We don't often get a chance to say that, but thank you. Really, thank you. If you want to chat to us, you can do that using Twitter or on Facebook, MySpace or in our forums. If you'd like to send us some feedback, you can send an email to garyandruth@celticmythpodshow.com. What have we got in this episode?
Well, we've got some great music, some stirring poetry, and a wonderful story by Chris Jolliffe. Oh, and a couple of pieces about Samhain traditions.
Excellent. Mm. So, let's kick off with some news and views.
Gary's been really busy scripting the shows for the first of the Welsh Tales. And he's been doing things with maps on Google Earth. How many translations did you come up with in the end?
Well, 8. But 3 of them were so close that I've come down to a basic 5 that we'll be working from. We'll put the details in each of the show notes of the stories for you.
Good grief, I didn't realise there were that many.
Well, I've been looking at them all closely and hopefully we'll all enjoy the results very shortly.
I'm sure we will. Well, it's Samhain, or Halloween, once again. And we thought we'd look at the traditions that surround the festival. And to help us do that, we have a great piece of writing called Samhain, the Lowering of the Veil. But first, to get us in the mood, from Dave the Bard, The Cauldron Born.
Oh, good. I always did like that one.
Did you say something?
No.
Oh, okay.
Sunset, moon, rise, and see how the land is bathed in silver hue. You feel so lonely. Come with me and let me show there are others just like you, who feel the powers of earth, sea and sky, of dragon and fairy and shades of the night. Hear the call of our ancestors of blood and bone, of womb and tomb and standing stone. Lady, stir your cauldron well, chant your words and sing your spell. Deep within this darkened hall, hear the goddess Ceridwen call. See her man alone on a hill, his arms raised high. Chanting words, a charm, a spell of power, a witch's rune. He calls to the powers of earth, sea and sky, of dragon and fairy and shades of the night. He calls to his ancestors of blood and bone, of wounds, tomb and standing stone. Lady, stir your cauldron well, chant your words and sing your spell. Deep within this darkened hall, hear the goddess Ceridwen call. Come and taste of the cauldron's brew, and magic she will give to you. You will dance in the eye of the storm, your Ceridwen's children, the cauldron born. A charm of silver, the gypsy said when he was just 17. Sure, I'll tell you every thread and turn, if there to be seen. She took his hands, tracing the lines, searching for patterns and looking for signs. Your life a construction, one day you will see. And into the dream. Lady, stir your cauldron well, chant your words and sing your spell. Deep within this darkened hall, hear the goddess Ceridwen call. Come and taste of the cauldron's brew, and magic she will give to you. You will dance in the eye of the storm, your Ceridwen's children, the cauldron born. So we stand on this hill, our shadows are cast by the moon. Words, our charm, our spell of power, our witch's rune. We call to the powers of earth, sea and sky, of dragon and fairy and shades of the night. We call to our ancestors of blood and bone, of womb and tomb and stand. Lady, stir your cauldron well, chant your words and sing your spell. Deep within this darkened hall, hear the goddess Ceridwen call. Come and taste of the cauldron's brew, and magic she will give to you. You will dance in the eye of the storm, your Ceridwen's children, the cauldron born. Oh lady, stir your cauldron well, chant your words and sing your spell. Deep within this darkened hall, hear the goddess Ceridwen call. Come and taste of the cauldron's brew, and magic she will give to you. You will dance in the eye of the storm, your Ceridwen's children, the cauldron born. You're the cauldron born.
Was The Cauldron Born by Dave the Bard from the album of the same name. I still love that track.
Me too. That took me back to when we were watching the filming for The Spirit of Albion, the movie, at night in that beautiful woodland.
That was a rather unforgettable experience, wasn't it?
Oh, it certainly was. Mm. But more of that, we'll tell you all about it in another show.
Okay then.
So, let's find out a little more about how the ancient Celts regarded Halloween, or Samhain as it's called.
Samhain, The Lowering of the Veil, by Jennifer Emick.
from the more ancient Irish form Samhain, was the most widely celebrated of the ancient Celtic festivals. It was a celebration of the harvest, of the closing of the year and the beginning of the new year. Agriculturally, it was the time when the last fruits of the harvest were collected and stored, and the livestock were culled and quartered for the winter ahead. The dark time of the year had many magical and mythical associations as well. Samhain was also the time when the gates of the other worlds were thrown open, allowing the spirits of the ancestors and the she-folk to mingle with the living. It was at this time that the fabled Wild Hunt, a procession of animals, fairies and spirits, was most often said to occur.
The history of Samhain. The Gauls marked the year into just two halves, the dark or winter half being Sam or Samonius, and the light half, Gam, or its Latinized form, Gamonius. Like other ancient cultures, the Celts marked the beginning of the day at sunset. Likewise, the year was counted at the beginning in its dark half. Caesar remarked on the practice in his writing on the Gallic Wars.
All the Gauls assert that they are descended from the god Dis, and say that this tradition has been handed down by the Druids. For that reason, they compute the divisions of every season not by the number of days, but of nights. They keep birthdays and the beginnings of months and years in such an order that the day follows the night.
The festival, now commonly referred to as Samhain, has numerous names. In Wales, it was known as Calan Gaeaf, Winter's Eve. In Ireland, it was Uecha Shambra, Samhain Night. Sometimes Pooka Night. In Manx, it is Samhain. Samonius, the dark half of the year, was reckoned first in the Celtic calendar. The festival marking the beginning of Samhain was Samhain, a three-day feast celebrated on the new moon, closest to the autumnal equinox. As Beltane marked the beginning of the summer season, Samhain marked its end. In fact, the word Samhain, summer's end, is the current Gaelic name for the month of November. In the 1st century Celtic Caligny calendar, a similar three-day festival ushered in the new year in late autumn.
The Samhain festival marked the transition between two very different seasons. The growth season was at an end, with the majority of crops long harvested. The time for festivals and tribal gatherings was coming to an end, and warfare and trade would be largely suspended until warmer weather returned. This was a last opportunity for merrymaking and celebration before a long winter confinement.
Samhain was celebrated at the cusp of the seasons, marking the end of the light and the beginning of the dark of the year. In mythical terms, the youthful aspect of the goddess sovereignty gave way to the withered hag of winter, and the fruits and flowers of the warm season were replaced with the barren cold of winter. It was marked at Tara with a great feast, the Feish Tomrach, or Mating of Tara, at which the High King was symbolically mated with the goddess of sovereignty. A celebration that marked the Samhain night coupling of the Morrigan and the Dagda on the eve of the Battle of Moytura.
Indeed, Samhain was a favourite time for tribal assemblies, during which all of Atua would gather together for feasting, games and amusements, but also to settle debts and disputes. In ancient times, great offerings would have been made at lakes, shafts, and the entrances of the she mounds, as the denizens of the otherworld will be particularly receptive. Horse races and other feats of strength were not uncommon at this time, a tradition going back to the earliest days of the Celtic peoples. In the Ulster Cycle story, The Wooing of Emma, the heroine refers to the festival of Samhain as,
"When summer goes to its rest."
Samhain was considered a time of great change. It was also a time of great transparency between the world of man and the other world. Samhain was a traditional time for divination and prophecy, an auspicious time for sacrifice. The transformation of the world brought about other transformations, and it was at this time one could enter the other world. Celtic myth tales involving otherworld magic often take place during Samhain, and it's at this time when otherworld denizens made benevolent journeys, or even warfare, against the living. Samhain was the preferred day for beginning an adventure or setting out on a quest, especially a divine one. Many important events in Celtic mythology take place or begin at the time of Samhain. For example, it is at Samhain that Aengus seeks to recognise his lover Caer in her swan form. A common urban legend claims that the Samhain celebration was in honour of a ghastly god of death by the same name. Although a few minor Celtic gods have similar names, none has any connection to the Samhain festivals. Samhain was celebrated all over Ireland and Great Britain with the lighting of sacred bonfires. As in similar rituals in the north, the Samhain fires were the first fires of the season. In a ritual that would repeat at Beltane, all other fires would be extinguished and ritually relit from the sacred bonfires.
The bonfires themselves were inaugurated by the Druids, the first, according to some accounts, on the hilltop of Tullachta, where it would be easily visible from Tara. The bonfires were not the only fire rituals associated with Samhain. A popular ritual called the Lating of Witches involved a solemn, candlelit procession, the purpose of which was the discovery of dark magic. If a candle flickered or died out during the procession, it meant that the person carrying it was a certain victim of witches, and special precautions would be taken to protect him or her. Other precautions would be taken as well. As the Tuatha Dé Danann were well known to roam the countryside, it was customary to leave gifts of milk and bread for them, not just on Samhain, but on other festival days as well. This customary offering was sometimes referred to as the fairy tax, honouring the ancient agreement between the Milesian Celts and the denizens of the other world.
Even after the demise of the pagan Celtic culture, Samhain remained a popular holiday. And in early Ireland, it was the most important of the four great festivals. There is a common theory that floats about that the institution of Halloween by the Catholic Church was intentionally begun as an answer to the reluctance of the people to give up pagan revelries or the remembrance of the dead. The truth is actually much less clear-cut. The various churches in the first centuries instituted celebrations of their saints and martyrs, which varied according to location, but were celebrated mostly in the spring. By the year 800, German and English churches were commemorating the saints on the 1st of November, and by 835, most of the rest had followed suit at the urging of Pope Gregory IV. Before this time, however, the Celtic observance was held in the springtime, near the Easter feast. Also, although there was a definite connection with death and passages, there isn't a lot of evidence that Samhain was held to honour the dead. Most such claims come much too late to be of any use, and the idea is never mentioned in the surviving mythological tales. It is a fair assumption, however, that in this traditional time of tribal gathering, some commemoration would have been made on behalf of the ancestors. It is known that it was sometimes customary to light torches at the entrances of the ancient tombs to make clearer the passage from the other world.
Christian practices rise. From the earliest days of the church, it was customary to observe a day in memorial to the saints. Later, this expanded to include all of the dead. The saints of the church were celebrated on November the 1st with a solemn mass and singing. It was already customary to honour one's ancestors during the Samhain period. It was only natural that the church's own observances followed suit. It became customary to visit cemeteries on this day, to sweep and clean the graves, and echoing the older custom, lights were lit outside of homes and in cemeteries. Water and other provisions would be left out, and the doors would be left unlocked. The ancient tombs were not neglected either. The old custom of walking in diesel procession three times round the ancient monuments were carried out well into medieval times. The November celebrations were eventually worn away as the popularity of the All Saints Festival increased. Within a few hundred years, the commemoration of the dead also moved from an earlier date to coincide with the November observation, so that eventually the two would be held back to back. In any case, the Christian observations were quite unlike their pagan predecessor, and by the medieval period, the feast became solemn reminders of mortality and the grisly fates awaiting the sinner. In medieval times, as during other feasts, it became customary to spend Samhain night going door to door collecting food and other offerings for the poor, often exchanged for prayers said for the homeowner. However, the Samhain ritual often involved a costumed masquerade, some say in imitation of the fairy procession. If a homeowner gave generously to these masked visitors, the visitors would make a solemn procession around the kitchen fire, a tradition that clearly echoes the ancient Samhain rituals. Were the hosts less generous, then they would be cursed in a similar manner.
It's interesting to see a comparison between the Halloween masquerade and the wild hunt, or the fairy raid.
Yes, it is. I haven't heard of that comparison before. It seems the original celebrations were happy and colourful, then in the Middle Ages became a sombre occasion, and now it's a celebration or holiday for many once again. We seem to have come full circle.
Indeed.
Sorry, what was that you said?
I said we seem to have come full circle.
You didn't say anything else?
No.
Never mind. It's time for some more music.
Well, what do we have now?
A beautiful song called The Realm of the Free by Cindy Spear and Colin Mould. Have a listen.
Here the dream for the soul was the strength of man, when the plowshare was born from the thoughts of the land. Under cold winter moons, in the absence of fear, the weave of your faith became brilliantly clear. And kings and their forts are still high on a hill. The old trappings of time, passionate wanderer, left his mark and designs to the realm of the free. Oh,
was that?
That was a lovely song. That was Realm of the Free by Cindy Spear and Colin Mould. And as ever, more details can be found in the show notes.
Now, staying with their Samhain traditions theme, we're going to hear about the Banshee from Lady Augusta Gregory.
Ooh, I've been looking forward to this one. Visions and Beliefs in the West of Ireland by Lady Augusta Gregory, 1920. Excerpts from Banshees and Warnings. Then Cahoolin went on his way, and Catbad, that had followed him, went with him. And presently they came to a ford, and there they saw a young girl, thin and white-skinned, having yellow hair, washing and ever-washing, and wringing out clothing that was stained crimson-red, and crying and keening all the time.
"Little hound,"
said Catbad.
"Do you see what it is that young girl is doing? It is your red clothes she is washing, and crying as she washes, because she knows you are going to your death against Maeve's great army."
Cahoolin of Moir Hem. From Cahoolin's day, or it may be from yet an earlier time, that a keening woman of the Sidhe has been heard giving her lamentable warning for those who are about to die. Rachel had not yet been heard mourning for her children when the white-skinned girl, whose keening had never ceased in Ireland, washed the red clothes at the ford. It was she, or one of her race, who told King Brian he was going to meet his death at Clontarf. Though after the defeat of the old gods, that warning had often been sent by a more radiant messenger. As when Colum Keeler, at the dawn feast of Pentecost, lifted his eyes and saw a great brightness and an angel of God there waiting above him. And Patrick himself had his warning through his angel, Victor, who met him on the road at midday to the barn where he'd lodged the night before, for it was there he had to die. Such a messenger may have been at hand at the death of that Irish-born mystic William Blake, when he burst into singing of the things he saw in heaven and made the rafters ring.
"A few years ago, the woman of the thatched house at the foot of Echta told me,
'There were great wonders done in the old times. And when my father that worked in the garden there above was dying, there came a sudden three flashes of light into the room, the brightest light that ever was seen in the world. And there was an old man in the room, and one roan, and I leaned back on him, for I had like to faint. And people coming the road saw the light, and up at Mick Irony's house, they all called out that their house was in flames. And when they came and heard of the three flashes of light coming into the room and about the bed, They all said it was the angels that were his friends that had come to meet him. When Rafferty died, the blind poet who wandered throughout Townland 100 years ago, some say there were flames about the house all through the night, and those were the angels waking him. Yet his warning had not been sent through these white messengers, but through a vision that had come to him once in Galway, when Death himself appeared.
Thin, miserable, sad and sorrowful, the shadow of night upon his face and the tracks of the tears down his cheeks.
And had told him that he'd had but 7 years to live. And though Rafferty spoke back to him in a scornful verse, there are some who say he spent those last 7 years in praying and making his songs of religion. To some it's a shadow that brings the warning, a noise of a knocking or a dream. At the hour of violent death, nature itself will show its sympathy. I've been told on a gloomy day that it had darkened because there was a man being hanged. And a woman who travelled told me that once at Bundoran, she'd seen the waves roaring and turning. And she knew later it was because at that very time, 2 young girls had been drowned.
Mrs. Curran.
My cousin Mary, that lives at the village beyond, told me that she was coming home yesterday week along the road, and she saw a girl that would not be afraid to walk the whole world with herself. And it was late, and suddenly there was a man walking beside her, inside the field on the other side of the wall. Well, at first she was frightened, but then she felt sure it was her cousin John that was dying. And then she wasn't afraid, for she knew her cousin would do her no harm. And after a while he was gone. And when she got near the home, she saw the lights, and she was frightened. And when she got into the house, she was in a sort of a faint. And next day, this day week, her cousin was dead.
Old Simon.
I heard the banshee crying not long ago, and within 3 days, the boy at the Murphy's was killed by his own horse, and he bringing his cart to Kinvara. And I heard it again a few nights ago, but I had no debt since then. What is the banshee? It is of the nature of the Highnesses. 6 families it cries for. The Highnesses and the Fays and I forget what are the others. I heard it beside the river at Ballylay one time. It would stand barefooted in the snow, listening to the tune she had, so nice and so calm and so mournful. And one time, I was walking the road, and I heard a great crying keening beside me. A woman that was keening, and she conveyed me 3 miles on the road. And I got to the door of the house and I looked down and I saw a little woman, very broad and broad-faced, about the bigness of the seat of that table, and a cloak about her. And I called out to her that it was my first wife. The Lord be with her. And she lighted a candle and I came in weak and I lay upon the floor. And I was till 12 o'clock that night lying in the bed. A man I was talking to said it was the banshee and it cries for 3 families. The Fays and the O'Briens and another, I forget which. And my grandmother was a Fay, and I suppose father or mother. It follows the generations. I heard it another time, and my daughter from America coming into the house that night. And it was the most mournful thing ever you heard. Keening about the house for the same term as before, till 12 o'clock at night. And within 5 months, my daughter from America was dead.
John Cloran.
There was a man near us that was ploughing a field, and he found an iron box, and they say there was in it a very old Irish book with all the knowledge of the world in it. Anyway, there's no question you could ask him, he couldn't answer. And what he says at the banshee is that it's Rachel's mourning still for every innocent of the earth that is going to die, like as she did for our Lord when the king had liked to kill him. But it's only for them that sprung from her own tribe that she'll hear her voice.
Mrs. Smith.
As for the banshee, where she stops is where in the old castle of Essekelly on the Roxburgh estate. Many a one has seen her there and heard her wailing and wailing. And she with a red petticoat put about her head. There was a family of the name of Fox in Monine, and never one of that family died, but she'd be heard keening them.
The Spinning Woman.
The banshee is all I ever saw myself. It was when I was a slip of a girl, picking potatoes along with the other girls. We heard a crying, crying in the graveyard beyond Rhine Rush. So we ran like fools to see who was being buried. And I was the first. And I leapt up at the wall. And there she was, and gave me a slap on de jour. And she was just like a country woman, with a red petticoat. Often I hear her crying if anyone is going to die in the village.
A seaside woman.
At one time, there was a man in the village, who dying, and I stood at the door in the evening. And I heard her crying the grandest cry ever you heard. And I said, Glyn's after a dying, and they're crying for him. And they all came to the door and heard it. But my mother went out after that and found him gasping still. Sure enough, 'twas the banshee we heard that evening. And out there where the turf boat is lying with its sail down, outside Orkneish, there the banshee does always be crying and crying for some that went down there sometime. At Fidoon, that strip of land between Tyrann and Durrus, something appears and cries for a month before anyone dies. A great many are taken away sudden there, and they say that it's because of that thing. The banshee cries every time one of the Shonaks dies, and when the old captain died, the crows all left the place within 2 days and never came back for a year.
Mrs. Curran.
I was in Galway yesterday, and I was told there that the night before those four boys were drowned, there were four women crying out on the rocks. Those that saw them say they were young and that they were out of this world. And one of those boys was out at sea all day, the day before he was drowned. And when he came into Galway in the evening, some boy said to him,
I saw you today standing up on the Howe Bridge.
And he was afraid, and he told his mother and said,
Why did they see me on the high bridge and I out at sea?
And the next day he drowned. Some say there was not much at all to drown them that day. A man near Athenry.
There is often crying heard before a death. And in that field beside us, the sound of washing clothes with a beetle is sometimes heard before a death. I heard crying in that field near the fort one night, and not long after, the man it belonged to died.
Old King.
I heard the banshee and I saw her. I and six others were card playing in the kitchen at the big house that is sunk into the ground. And I saw her up outside the window. She had a white dress and it was as if held over her face. And they all looked up and saw it. And they were all afraid and went back. But myself. And then I heard a cry that did not seem to come from her, but from a good way off. And then it seemed to come from herself. And she made no attempt to twist the mournful cry, but all she said was,
Ooh. Ooh.
Oh, but it was as mournful as the oldest of the old women could make it that was best at crying the dead. Old Mr. Shonak was at Listoon Varner at the time, and he came home a few days after and took to the bed and died. It's always the banshee as full of the Shonaks and cried them.
Mrs. King.
There was a boy at the Norton that died not far from this. A fine young man. And I set out to go to the burying, and Mrs. Burke along with me. But when we came to the gate, we could hear her crying for the dead, and I said, It's as good for us to wait where we are, for they've brought the corpse out and they're crying for him. So we waited for a while, and no one came. And so we went on to the house, and we had 2 hours to wait before they brought out the corpse for the burying. And there had been no crying at all till he was brought out. We knew then who it was that was crying, for if the boy was a Norton, it's in his house of the Kearns he died, and the banshees always cried for the Kearns.
The Old Army Man.
As to the invisible world, I hear enough about it, but I've seen but little myself. One night, when I was at Calcutta, I heard that one Connor was dead, a man I'd been friendly with. So I went to his house. There was a good many of us there, and when it came to just before midnight, I heard a great silence fall, and I looked from one to another to see the silence. And then there came a knock at the window, just as the clock was striking 12. And Connor's wife said,
It was just at this hour last night there came a knock like that, and immediately afterwards he died.
And the strange thing is, it was a barrack room and on the second story, so that no one could reach it from the street. And then again, in India, before Delhi, there was an officer's servant lodged in the same house as me, who was thrown out of his cot every night. And as sure as midnight came, the dogs couldn't stop outside, but would come shrinking and howling into the house. Yes, indeed. I believe the fairies are in all countries, all over the world. But the banshee, that's only in Ireland. Though sometimes in India I would think of her when I hear the hyenas laughing. Keening. Keening you can hear her, but only for the old Irish families. But you'll follow them, even as far as Dublin.
Banshee's been heard in other parts of the world. I thought she followed families and wasn't bound by place. I'd be interested to know if anybody knows if she brings death warnings in other parts of the world. If you know, do let us know, won't you?
It'd be fascinating to find out. She also seems to be mixed up with this washer at the ford. The woman that washes blood from the clothes of those going to die. She's often linked with the Kailuch or the Morrigan.
Yeah, it almost seems as they're all aspects of the same fairy or deity. Interesting stuff. Well, if anybody can add anything to the Fat Banshee folklore for us, please do let us know.
Well, that leads us nicely into our next piece of music, which is She's the Crone by that wonderful artist, Kellyana.
She is teacher and experience. She is wisdom. She is crone. She is teacher and experience. She is wisdom. She is crone. She stirs the cauldron of all knowledge. She is the bringer of death and rebirth. She stirs the cauldron of all knowledge. She is the bringer of death and rebirth. She is teacher and experience. She is wisdom. She is crone. She is teacher and experience. She is wisdom. She is crone. In the darkness, time of Samhain. In the dream time, she sits and stirs. In the darkness, the time of Samhain. In the dream time, she sits and stirs, sits and stirs. She is teacher and experience. She is wisdom. She is grown. She is teacher and experience. She is wisdom. She is grown. Lead you to your dark mind, and at the crossroads, she'll be your guide. She will lead you to your dark mind, and at the crossroads, she'll be your guide. She is teacher and experience. She is wisdom. She is grown. She is teacher and experience. She is wisdom. She is grown. 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 crossroads with the cauldron of all knowledge. She sits and stirs at the crossroads with the cauldron of all knowledge. She sits and stirs, sits and stirs. She is crone, 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 she is crone.
That was Kellyanna with She's the Crone, from her album Elemental. And as you'd expect, more details in the show notes. What a good song. I love the way it's upbeat.
Great, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of people see the crone as something bad, but to the ancient Celts, she was the bearer of wisdom, as well as the harshness of winter. What do they say? No pain, no gain?
Very true.
What do you reckon? Should we have some poetry now?
Yep, sounds a great idea to me.
Here is a courtly poem from our talented friend, Chris Jolliffe. Forget Me Not by Chris Jolliffe. Forget me not, though I am dead. Take thou no lover to thy bed. Thou still art mine, though I am gone. Me alone shalt thou belong, for still beside thy bed I stand. Touch your fair cheek with my pale hand, till cockerels crow and morning light dispels all shadows of the night. And on the sword bridge I will tread. Forget me not, though I am dead. Forget me not, though I am dead. For we eternal souls are wed. Keep faithful yet thy vows to me, and nightly shall I watch o'er thee. But should thee fail thy pledge of faith, that night to thee shall come my wraith. Thy living hand in mine I'll take, thy ghost with mine the journey take. Across the sword bridge we shall tread. Forget me not, though I am dead.
The veil thins.
Did you just hear something?
Only the poem.
Okay.
Thank you, Chris, for your haunting poem. I wonder, was that the knight speaking in the poem, or was it the lady?
Good question. I actually think it could have been either. What do you guys think? Chris, let us know if it was actually written one way or the other. I'd be interested to know.
Absolutely. So now on to our last piece about Samhain Halloween traditions. Soul caking.
Soul cakes, or Solmas cakes, are the traditional Celtic precursor to modern trick-or-treating. For centuries throughout European history, the dates of October the 31st, All Hallows Eve, and November the 1st, All Saints Day, and November the 2nd, All Souls Day, were known as the season of Hallowtide, which was marked by a procession of mummers going from door to door or town to town, begging for soul cakes. In the 19th century, the custom of souling was performed by adults and children. People would walk from town to town on Halloween night, singing and begging for soul cakes. The soul cakes were actually round pieces of bread made with currants and spices. The cakes may have been accompanied by little slips of paper with a deceased family member's name, and in return for the cake, a prayer would be said for the soul of the deceased. The more soul cakes people received, the more prayers they had to say for the dead family members of the donors.
Oh, I see.
Mm. During this time, people believed the dead remained in limbo for a while after death. They also thought that prayer, even by strangers, could speed up the soul's passage to heaven. There was also often the handing out of soul cakes to the poor citizens, and it was also in exchange for prayers for the family's dead relatives. The church encouraged this as a way to replace the ancient practice of leaving food and wine on the doorsteps for roaming spirits. One of the very few surviving mumming play teams, which have a claim to be traditional, the Soul Cakers perform their souling play every year at Halloween and the following 2 weeks around the vicinity of the village of Antrobus in Cheshire. As is usual with this type of play, the basic action is that King George and the Black Prince fight, and the latter is killed and brought back to life by a doctor. And the last characters to enter are the wild horse, Dick, and his driver. The wild horse is made up of a real horse's skull, painted black, mounted on a pole, and held by a man bent double under a Calvert canvas cover, a construction defined as a hobby horse. The driver's attempt to control his cavortings and misbehaviour are the highlight of the play for many of the audience. A local team is known to have performed up to the First World War and then lapsed for a while, being revived in the late 1920s at the instigation of a Major A.W. Boyd, a well-known local country life author. And it's been regularly performed ever since.
Good for him.
Mm-hmm.
Not quite the same as today's celebrations, though.
No. Apparently, soul cakes also had crosses on them. They sound a bit like hot cross buns, don't they?
We get
at Easter.
Yeah. Mm. Well, as a fitting piece of music for this part of the show, we have a song by the very talented Kate Ann Corwin. The Cheshire Soul Caking Song.
A soul cake, please good missus, a soul cake, an apple, a pear, a plum or a cherry, any good thing to make us all merry, one for Peter, two for Paul, three for him who made us all. God bless the master of this house, the mistress also, and all the little children that round the table grow. Likewise, young men and maidens, your cattle and your store, and all that dwell within your gates, we wish you 10 times more. A soul, a soul, a soul cake, please good missus, a soul cake, an apple, a pear, a plum or a cherry, any good thing to make us all merry, one for Peter, two for Paul, three for him who made us all. Down into the cellar and see what you can find. If your barrels are not empty, we hope you will prove kind. We hope you will prove kind with your apples and strong beer. And we'll come no more a-souling until this time next year. A soul, a soul, a soul cake, please good missus, a soul cake, an apple, a pear, a plum or a cherry, any good thing to make us all merry, one for Peter, two for Paul, three for him who made us all. The lanes are very dirty and my shoes are very thin. I've got a little pocket to put a penny in. If you haven't got a penny, a halfpenny'll do. If you haven't got a halfpenny, it's God bless you. A soul, a soul, a soul cake, please good missus, a soul cake, an apple, a pear, a plum or a cherry, any good thing to make us all merry, one for Peter, two for Paul, three for him who made us all.
That was the Cheshire Soul Caking Song by Kate Fletcher and Corwin ap Broch.
I love that song. It's been going round and round in my head for the last week.
It's great, isn't it?
I bet it does to you as well.
Thank you to Kate Fletcher and Corwin ap Broch. Kate and Corwen perform English folk and historical music, and you can find out more about the fascinating duo and the amazing work that they do in the show notes. Worth looking up as well.
Mm. That was great, wasn't it? You can just imagine groups of people on dark autumn evenings, faces aglow from the light of a candle in a turnip, turning up on the doorstep and singing that song. Mm. Whew. I've gone all shivery now. Mm.
I know what you mean.
Who said that?
Who said what?
I know what you mean.
Do you?
Oh, I give up. Anyway, on with the show.
Okay. You know you mentioned mummers just now?
Yes.
Well, that happens to be the answer to our Pentacle Drummers competition for the last CD of their album, Life in Tatters.
Hmm. So what was the question again?
Okay. Old English folk customs.
Customs?
Old English, even them. Old English folk customs often see groups perform in tatters, that is, raggedy clothes. You can see photos in the show notes for the Chatterbox show. There are drumming groups, like ours, Morris dancers, Border Morris, and a type of group who perform traditional plays that have essentially remained the same for years and years. So the question was, what are these performers called?
And the answer was mummers.
And the winner is... Emma!
Congratulations, Emma. We've sent an email asking for your snail mail address, and we'll get the CD winging its way to you very shortly.
Congratulations.
And now it's time for our story.
Samhain's Story by Chris Jolliffe. The old woman stirs the cauldron on the last fire of the year. She hears the dog barking in the yard. The sound of the gate dragged open, mutters to herself about uninvited guests and trouble, rubble. But she sighs. She knew someone would come. On this night, they're bound to. And she has such work to be doing. But she reminds herself, wisdom is given so that wisdom may be given. I can't recall who first told her that. Perhaps it was herself as a younger woman. Or an older one. She forgets. She whistles sharply, setting the white sow grunting in her pen. Her daughter comes running up to the hollow in the hillside, comely in the dusk that cannot dim her beauty. Her son hides himself with the pigs, the night not dark enough to cover his ugliness. Ugh, she'll have to leave her old bald fool of a husband to mind the pot. There's nothing to be done for it. Salmon stew will spit if not stirred well.
Ah, oh, well, wise woman.
She grumbles.
Go and be wise.
From the village, of course, bearing corn and fruit and mead to offer her. And with them come a brindled calf, a babe in arms. A blushing maiden. What will the new year bring? How many will the winter kill? How well will the spring revive? Will the herd be strong? Will the child grow well? Will the maiden marry? The questions are always the same. A second pot then, boiled and called before. Dark berries for dreaming. Because she knew, as she always knows. And as she sways and slurs, the magic comes. And in its depths she loses and then finds herself again. They crowd around her, breathless, stilled, faces in low firelight and last breath the last day. And in the stillness, her new old voice is calling.
One for what will die,
she cries.
One for what will live, and one for what will be again.
And no one thinks to challenge what she asks. And as the sun dies into darkness and the whispers hiss and crackle from the embers, the smoke thickens and twirls above the fire. A veil that thins, chokes throats, and speaks with a stolen breath.
Death comes to every life in time.
It croaks.
And I shall reap my harvest from you all. The corn shall turn to dust. The ewe-eyed calf come to the axe. The virgin's cheek shall wrinkle, and the dancing back be bent. All shall die. I answer you that life should live before it fails. Years I shall give to you, and years take. Those that are due to live shall live. Those due to die shall die. I shall be mindful of your tears, and spare my hunger, for on this night I rode the dagger's life and drank deep draughts of death at Katmaitora, where over Lu's bright chariot I flew. For a god's heart given for Danann blood and for more skulls, I grant a year of lusty life and peaceful passing. I Morrigan, vow and speak no more.
And as the smoke thins and the cold voice ends, the woman shivers but endures. The wind whistles and the baby cries. But as the whirligig of breezes swirls the smoke away, the wailing turns to gurgles and to laughter, pealing from those tiny lips in pink-faced chuckles. And in those chuckles is a father's kind voice heard. Hope with love is sown, and with love lives. So shall it be for hearts when spring has come. No winter's chill or stony grave can stop the budding leaf, and even omens cannot curse the heart to hold no hope. And well know I, by ill stars marked, by fortune failed, by kinfolk shunned, a life-lacked heart was mine. But yet I hoped, and on this night came to my empty nets no fish. But true, I tell a better prize, for I found life, new love, and grew to greater times. For a bright-browed babe and all the life that love can give, I bless you, heart and hearth. I, Elfin, vow, and speak no more. And the woman mutters, half in hate, half in humour. But she's a mother still, and mother's love, unless she smiles. And all is still beneath the middle night. The moon is but a thread, thin, silver ring, as if the upturned edges of a bowl that pours out stars upon the sky. And as intangible as is the moment past, a voice is heard from far beyond and deep within, by heart and head and soul. What was and is, and is to be, shall come as it has gone, and as it ever shall be so. There shall be life and love and plenty, fool and fire. But what and which and where is never known. With
With Clath beginning, have I seen the future and the past. And of that wheel I spoke through madness, and through madness have I been misunderstood. What shall I tell you of the year to come? I shall be born, and I shall rule, shall die the triple death and yet return. Dragons will coil, red and white before my eyes. Swords flame, spears rise and darkness fall. But this bright land shall shine, and shall endure while hearts hold true and tales be told. And therefore remember, in the past the future shall be found. Thus listen to the aged wise, let the youth seek truths before their time. Love life, and fear not death, for we are born through light and darkness on the wheel. What was and is to be shall come. I, Merlin, vow and speak no more.
And the woman sighs and shudders, and released from all the worries of the year gone, sleeps. To each is given from the bright hand of her daughter apples, cut across so that the five-point star within may grant its sacred secret blessing. Her shadowy brother brings out brands lit from the embers of the fire past to show each traveller home. And homeward bound they go, with torches in their hands and hope within their hearts. And through the newborn darkness walk with joy to greet the rising sun. And an old man sucks his thumb and chuckling runs, hopping from the cooling cauldron, mindful of the chickens. And the old woman stirs.
Well, thank you, Chris. What a great story.
Oh, it was. I loved how all the characters were brought in with their prophecies. Well, we're nearly at the end of this Samhain special.
Yes, and sadly, we are nearly at the end. But we have one more song for you. It's The Wonderful Shores of Wales by Crefan Kirk.
And thought he of his own sweetheart, he did not hear the horn that sounded faintly far behind from beyond the bourne. But soon he heard the pounding hooves that shook the very ground, and with a mighty rushing wind the riders ringed him round. Their eyes shone in the bladed night, they smelled of earth and air, with voices like a howling wind. Their faces cruel and fair. And for to ride on Hallows Eve, demanded they their toll, and gave him then a race to win for his life and soul. Oh, ride, young William, ride tonight, elf lands on your trail, to take your soul if you should lose upon the shores of Wales. Then came to him a midnight horse, whose rider wore a crown, and gazing at him with a smile, bade him to step down. A steed as red as blood or gold was given to his rein. A fairy mount to match my own evens out the game. Know you, sir, the gallows oak that overlooks the sea? A league or more straight on from here, that our goal shall be. And if you win home, you shall go free from curse or pain. But if I catch you, mine you'll be, and come not home again. Then William bravely up and cried, these terms be far from fair. I stand to lose my own dear soul, and you not one small hair. A blacksmith now by trade I am, your risk must match my own. I'll forge your soul into my swords, and steel shall be your armor. Ride, young William, ride tonight, elf lands on your trail, to take your soul if you should lose upon the shores of Wales. So be it, cried the Midnight King, to yours I pledge my soul. They brought their horses side by side, and faced them towards the goal. And faster than the wind they flew, William rode the storm, and behind them came the elven host, winding on their horns. That veiled in tangled cloud and sank down through the trees. And William's horse walked slow and cold beside a murmuring sea. Upon an empty shore of Wales, it was All Hallows Eve.
The
That was The Shores of Wales by Cray Van Kirk. You can find out more about Cray and his music in the show notes. He was with us in our last special, wasn't he?
Yes, he's an amazing man with an amazing philosophy about music. Check him out, it's well worth it. Well, that really is the end of our Samhain special.
Is it?
Yes, didn't it go fast?
Yeah.
Thank you for staying with us, and we'll be back very soon with the start of the Welsh Tales. So until then, Hwyl fawr.
Happy Halloween.
Did you hear something?
No. And the light half, gam, or its Latinised force, or its Latinised form.
I am your father, Luke.
Okay, sorry. Keep faithful yet thy vowels to me. My vowels. And my bowels to me.
Mummers.
And the winner is...
Apparently it's the Cauldron Born is the winner.
You've been listening to the Celtic Myth Pod Show, available from CelticMythPodShow.com.
We hope you've enjoyed the show and will stay tuned for the next episode. You can send us an email or some voice feedback to Gary and Ruth at CelticMythPodShow.com. The show notes for this episode can also be found on the website. We'd like to say a special thank you to Coulan's Hounds, who provided us with the theme music for our show. Find them at www.sfhounds.com. We'd also like to say a big thank you to Anne Roos, Master Harper, and Keltoria, with a K, Celtic New Age Music, who have both given the show unrestricted access to their music. And thanks again go to Diane Arkinstone and Kim Robertson, whose music has been used as some of the transitions you've heard in this show. You'll find links to all of these wonderful artists in the show notes at shownotes.celticmythpodshow.com.